Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
But I woke up back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia, on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150 plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, who's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larcher. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Captain, good morning, sir.
Good morning,
Joe. First morning show we've done in a while.
I'd like to point out to all our listeners we're recording this on Memorial Day weekend, and I would like to extend a great greeting to all United States Armed Forces veterans, including yourself, Joe, to have a very happy and very pleasant, peaceful Memorial Day weekend and Memorial Day on Monday.
You gave me goosebumps, Bob. Thank you for that. That was great.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for our service to our country, Joe, and all our veteran listeners out there. It's interesting to me, football aside, in many cases we don't really understand the sacrifices of what our veterans have gone through over the years since the inception of our country in 1776. And it's something to be proud of. It's something never to forget. And I will conclude by saying freedom is not free by any way, shape, or
indeed
form or means. Now on to football.
Indeed.
Yep. It's been a while.
Yep.
I realize that it's off season. The Alliance of American Football went kaput. It was enjoyable watching a few spring games because I'm not really a big NBA, NHL, MLB fan. I prefer football in its purest forms, and it's not uncommon on the TV downstairs at the compound here that YouTube is playing some old football highlight reels, or to get me in the mood, some old USFL games that I remember quite well. But anyways, that's not what we're going to talk about. I'm going to let you introduce what we're going to talk
about this morning. Very, very excited about today's show. We have an amazing guest on, Mike Driscoll, who's a Jim Thorpe collector, like myself, an avid Jim Thorpe collector. Puts my collection to shame. So we're excited to talk about him. This morning we got some emails of some pictures of some of the items in his collection, and it's pretty amazing, I must say. But the topic that I'm really, really excited about is we all know in this hobby there are legends. There's some myths, there's some folklore. Like, I heard this story once about Dick Butkus kicking an extra point in his last professional game, and Joe Theismann held the football. True or not? It's a pretty damn good story. I'm going to have to look that one up one of these days. On this show, we've heard whispers, allegations, innuendos, hints. And what we're going to talk about today is one of those legends, those myths. It's the Captain's Football Notebook. In various shows, we've heard Bob talk about this, where he's like, I'll have to check my notebook on that. I've got notes on that. I remember seeing that at a show and taking notes down. So for the past week, Bob and I have been exchanging texts and emails where I'm asking him questions about this urban myth. Our own ambassador of football, Bob Swick, the Jefferson Burdick of football, cataloging. At one point, I even asked him, I'm like, you know, in the 80s, when you were looking at these, did you take sketches of this stuff, or did you take pictures? It was kind of interesting. And then Bob capped it off sending me some pictures of his collection, and it's something to behold. I'm going to try and get permission to post one picture up on our social media a little later. But kind of cool. Bob's notebooks go back to the 80s. Most of us who collected as a kid, and then at some point discovered girls, and then we go away to college or trade school or whatever it is, and then at some point something brings us back to the hobby. That's my case, and Bob's a little different. We all know that in 1965, Bob bought his first pack with his father's nickel of 1965 Philadelphia, and then he moved on to Topps. I believe it or not, that backwards, Bob? Which was your first pack, Philly or Topps?
Yeah, it was Topps first, then the Phillies, and so it was memories etched in my mind forever, opening those packs.
So in 1965, were a young, mustachioed Bob Swick's first packs, his first brush with football as a collection. And then Bob mentioned he started taking notes in 1976 when he started writing down as much as he could when he would discover things at shows. And then he started his notes in 1987. So a 9-year gap there where Bob was collecting. And I asked him, I said, you have a 22-year gap. You have a 22-year gap from 65 to 87 when you started, writing stuff down. Were you out of the hobby? And his reply was, no, I was always in the hobby. I just started taking notes in 1986. Bob, can you describe one of your notebooks that you sent me some pictures of, please? And it's everything you would imagine to our listeners.
Well, the notebooks encompass several ideas in my mind, and again, not really knowing if there was a right way or wrong way of doing things, I've always been the type to write things down. I have list upon lists for things to do, and Brenda's impressed with my organizational skills to a certain degree. She's also amazed by the amount of lists I keep. So anyways, back then, I started writing down how much I was spending when I would go to a show or if I bought a wax box. Now, traditionally, wax boxes way back when went wholesale from anywhere from like $8 to roughly $10.80 or $11 a box. So if I bought a box like at a candy store wholesale, I would write down what I paid for. If I went to a show, And I sent you an example of a show in 1987 that I went to. I spent $8 at the show. I bought 10 packs of 1983 Topps football wax at 30 cents a pack. And I kind of remember the guy had them in the rest of the box, and he just wanted to get rid of them. So he said, give me $3 for the packs. I do not know if he gave me the box or not. And then another guy had a cheese box, my infamous cheese box purchases that were well known over the years. He had a box of, I believe, 524 cards. And at that time, I would break down the box and see what was in it. And I would write down what cards were from what years. That box was mainly 1976 Topps football. There wasn't anything really exceptional in the box. There were no Peyton rookies or anything like that. So, but again, getting cards at a penny a piece were a pretty good deal, to say the least. So anyways, over the years, I wrote down everything I bought and sold. Over the years, if I found something at a show and it wasn't in my Beckett book at the time, and I'm looking, and I showed you one of my earliest books that I had.
Your old beat up Beckett book.
Yeah, and I sent you the picture of what the Mayos were going for. I knew you would have a good laugh on that one.
The description of the description of the anonymous in that Beckett book was pretty interesting.
Yeah. If the card
there's one notebook. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
Just summarize, if I couldn't find it in the book, I would write notes on it and try to figure out what it was, so on and so forth. So,
yeah. There was one notebook you sent me a snapshot of, and it was a summary. And I asked Bob at one point, I'm like, do you keep this in Excel spreadsheet or Word doc? And he's like, no, I prefer handwritten, just like he just said a moment ago. So I asked him for some pictures of some of these fabled legends notebooks. And again, this is the ambassador of football. This gentleman that I'm speaking to has been a collector since 1965, since well before I was born. So we're talking hobby. You are our captain. You had notes on what you'd spent collecting each set. And I went through and did a quick tally. And on the 1948 Leaf was your number one, the highest price set that you spent money on, followed by the Bowman. 48 Bowman, 52 Bowman, and 63 Fleer. I found it odd that you had to spend that much money on Fleer. Those four sets comprised one-fifth of everything you've ever spent on football. Why was the 63
Correct.
Fleer so expensive?
Well, again, when I bought some of these cards, obviously football cards came out of the woodwork with the explosion of 1989. And then I decided in earnest back in 87, I really would like to complete a lot of these sets that I had like a handful of cards from. So I unfortunately, and again, this was pre-internet days, I unfortunately overpaid on a lot of cards because I just wouldn't find them. I couldn't see them, that type of thing. And that's why that whole price sheet that I sent you is skewed toward those cards. My 48 Leaf set is anywhere from beyond poor to near mint, with miscuts, writing on cards, so on and so forth. For what I paid for that set, that is not a good value for that set. But at the time, not being able to find the high numbers, I really overpaid for the high numbers, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, got
and
it.
I overpaid for the 63 Fleers at the same time. However, my 63 Fleer set is in very, very nice shape. There's only a couple cards that need upgrading. That's basically a near-mint set. 48 Bowman was brutal because of the cards ending in 3. Couldn't find those, overpaid for those, so on and so forth. The same thing with that other Bowman set. But, again, I got a lot of other sets that there's minimal amount of money put into them, and they are obviously, in theory, worth more than what I had into them.
Speaking of minimal, and I noticed you spent $31 on your 77 top set, and you got to figure about 25 of that's on the Steve Largent card.
It was. I did want a nice condition Largent for that set, but I got to tell you a story about that 77 set. I obviously bought PAX, and I was putting it together, and I was at a show, and I did get a chance to look it up. I was at a show in the time frame of the mid-'80s, and I bought the set for $31. So that's why I have it there.
Wow.
And I put together another 77 cent. I sold it or traded it over the years. I needed like 100 cards from that set. So that was interesting. Good observation on your part.
The favorite picture that you sent me was one with a shelf of yours with all of your binders, your pocketed binders. Bottom shelf, 1970 to 1979 binders with all football, and then up top, it's 80 to 88. And then leaning in front of it, Packer Walker Cleaner Bo Melinda, just leaning up against it. Is that your type? Your type from the set that you'd like to look at every day?
Yeah, I have a couple of tight Packer pieces that I do keep on display at all times. And on that same shelf, if you go to the tippy top of the shelf, I have a little Packers paperback library there that I've kept over the years. Those pictures are out of my man cave, and I do have some of my excess inventory in there. I also have it in the garage here at the compound. But anyways, I do pull out those binders and I look at them. On a regular basis, I do enjoy, spending an evening. I'll take an error. I'll go through them. Obviously, my favorite error is 60 to 69, looking through them and seeing what I have there and the like.
Yep. It's very fun to look at how someone collects and organizes. And it was incredibly insightful to hear, to see the ambassador's collection. And I'm going to send you off something that I'm going to send you off a nice signed Steve Largent rookie card, and I'd be honored if you would place it on that shelf as a gentle reminder to your friend on the West Coast.
I will. I'll put it with my other autographed football pieces that I have, and I do keep any of them that I have. And I'll tell you a real quick story just as an aside. As we know, Forrest Gregg passed away recently. And I was able to get his ending, one of his last autographs on a print, beautiful print. And you could tell Forrest was aging and he was not in great shape. But I treasure all my autographs of football players, especially those who played in different eras than what we have today. But anyways, I would be honored, Joe, to get
outstanding
autograph of Steve Largent. All right, we're about ready to move on. Again, we could take this up at a later time too. We can always talk about my different items, but the notebook reference. I have about 16 notebooks. They're battered and beaten up to a large degree, but there's a lot of information in there, and it's fun to go back and look at them. And again, when I was writing for Sports Collectors Digest years ago, I would take any notes for an article and write them in my notebook. When I did my newsletter, Football Times, back in the 90s, I did the same exact thing. And in the move, when we moved here almost 10 years ago, I did get rid of some stuff. And again, you just can't keep every scrap of paper, every conceivable piece. You know what I mean? So I kind of condensed a lot of stuff to what I thought was the most relevant of anything. I mean, I was bad. I mean, I was just keeping the envelope of the letter that I received from Sports Collectors Digest of whatever the correspondence was with date stamps on it and the like. So that was a little over above. But
yeah, that is.
In any event, I'd like to welcome our special guest who we've announced already. He has an incredible historical collection of Jim Thorpe cards and memorabilia items. He hails from Oklahoma, and I'd like to welcome to our show Mr. Michael Driscoll. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hello, Captain and Joe. I want to thank you for inviting me, and I'm really humbled to be invited to visit with you guys. I've put this collection together by sitting on the couch. through eBay and online. And we don't have shows in Oklahoma, and the time constraints of living life and coaching and teaching and raising families just don't get to travel to go meet guys like you and other collectors in the hobby. And I ended up meeting a fellow here, Robert Newman, who was a longtime collector and then set up at Nationals before, and I showed him part of my collection. He said, you need to let other people see these items and share them with the hobby. There will be people out there really appreciate it. And so that's when I reached out to actually it was on Net 54, and Carl Lamdola helped me get set up. I don't know much about computers, and he helped me get set up where I could start posting. And then Jeffrey kind of hijacked me off of there to to the football forum, vintage forum, and he I appreciate him staying on me for several months to get me signed up over there, and meet a lot of people.
We appreciate we appreciate you posting. We appreciate you sharing your amazing collection. Seriously, Mike, you have an amazing collection.
You know, off script a bit, I over the years have seen, and I've been really blessed to see some amazing, amazing collections that just blow me away. And Mike, I just got to say, and I'm going to go ahead and then go back. You know, the email you sent yesterday on your top items, I must have stared at it for about 20 minutes. And I'm saying to myself, the history that's there is just truly unbelievable to me. And again, I've gone after Knights at the National. I've driven with guys who showed me their collections and their homes, you know, almost like a fortress I'm walking into. And I'm just floored by what I see and what's out there. And, you know, you don't need to go to the Pro Football Hall of Fame to have a Hall of Fame collection. So I'm going to start out by asking you, Mike, how did you start collecting Jim Thorpe items?
I think it began, the seed was planted in my childhood while living on a 160-acre property. My dad was a history buff and a reading teacher, and collected virtually anything from the past. And around 1970, he brought home Jim Thorpe, Indian Athlete by Guernsey Van Lifer from the school library, and he told me who Thorpe was and that he grew up just 30 miles west of us. I was in Okemo, Oklahoma, and Thorpe grew up around Prague, Oklahoma. And so I read that book, and I actually, in my mind, became Jim Thorpe while fishing and hunting out on that property.
Wow.
And we have a childhood idol. And we eventually moved to a town, and that's when I discovered football and baseball and basketball cards were out there in second grade. So I collected until high school, and then just like y'all were talking about, I stepped away until the early 2000s when I started getting the early. And I was so far behind in collecting cards from when I'd stopped that I just couldn't decide what to collect. Well, I then discovered eBay. I came upon a Thorpe Grange material card, the very first Thorpe Grange card that was made. And I immediately knew what I wanted to collect. Just childhood memory.
What do you mean by a material card? What do you mean a material card?
Like the relic cards.
The relic cards. Got it.
Relic cards where they cut up game-used material.
Yeah,
And then, you know, unfortunately, they cut up some of Thorpe's items, which is, you know, to me a travesty, but that's a whole different story there. And so I started amassing a card collection and ended up with 485 of the Thorpe relic cards before I put on the brakes.
And, wow.
Yeah.
Holy muck.
Then that led me to purchasing a PSA 8 in the Sport Kings and 55 All-American and a 1922 Zenith and a 1916 PSA 3 Famous and Bar. And that led me to start branching a few memories. And I think, Joe, you've probably seen that Type 1 photo of the 1911 Carlisle team I used to have and ended up needing to sell. And then my favorite piece of all that I'll talk about later, it was a Big Chief writing tablet given to Thorpe when he enrolled in Carlisle in 1904. And I missed out on his wool blanket from Carlisle. I mean, virtually by probably 15 seconds on eBay. I saw it and started buying it. And when I clicked to buy it, it was bought. So,
What year did you discover eBay? When did you start circling back into the hobby?
2003, probably. 2004.
Okay. You rattled off some pretty damn good cards there, Mike. The PSA 8 Sports King, Jim Thorpe, 55 Tops All-American, the 1916 M101 Sports Bar. I mean, just you've got some not to mention the – you know, the Z-Nut with him as a Portland Beaver. He's dressed up as a Portland, Oregon Beaver in that photo, of all things. So
that's a beautiful card. I like it.
Yeah. Those are some pretty impressive cards in your collection.
Well, thank you. When I finally realized that I had a sickness and couldn't buy every Thorpe material card in existence, I started selling them off. Yeah, you know, sometimes you think you can get it all, and then you realize you can't. Yeah. And so I sold 465 of them and kept just the more elite cards of it. And I decided I wanted to refocus my collection towards Thorpe memorabilia, photos, and items relating to the 1912 Olympics. You know, I do still collect and feel like I and a couple of other Thorpe card collectors helped create a market for the modern Thorpe cards after being in the July 2005 and May, June 2007 Beckett football magazines about our card collection. And after that, the Thorpe material price really shot up, and that's especially when I realized I can't get them all. A huge modern common Thorpe card started being produced. Week 3 probably owned 85% of the Thorpe relic cards at one time. And no longer, of course, I sold most of mine. But I do believe we helped create an interest in Thorpe again. At the time, there were probably 20 Thorpe cards before the material cards came out. Now there are over 1,000 common and material cards.
Yeah.
We own over 600 different ones. Now, I know
you sound like me when I was. You sound like me when I was trying to buy every Steve Largent rookie card that hit eBay. And that was before PayPal, so I had to send checks off and everything. Whenever people ask me why I collect, Jim Thorpe or Red Grange, my reply is always the same. It's because they deserve it. These are people who, paved the way for modern football. And quite frankly, they deserve to be recognized and for someone in today's time to shine a light on them and what they accomplished. So I don't know. You rattled off quite a few things just now, and you sent us an email yesterday with some, quite frankly, like Bob said, some incredibly impressive pictures. And I did the same thing. I scrolled through there, zooming in, looking at things. Well, can you give us a recap of the top five items or top five or six items in your collection you sent us some photos of?
Oh, yeah. That, and, you know, in anybody's collection, it's always hard to cut those out. You know, you got, for me, and especially something like Thorpe, there's just not as much material and items to buy out there. So any vintage item you get, it's almost like, now this is my favorite. And so all my postcards, you know, didn't make it. And the photos of where he went to school as a boy, as a 6 through 9 year old, I've got original photos of that place, an Indian school here in Oklahoma. And all my Type 1 photos, and there's a Coney Island arcade card that Jeff Payne said he's never seen one, and that, as far as he knows, it's the only one out there that has appeared. And then, I've got a train crate from his Oorang football days that belonged to him that didn't make the top six, and a couple recent purchases, one that Joe really liked and sent me a nice little friendly email about it. I know he liked it a whole lot, and it was a postcard that nobody had ever seen. You know, that didn't make it in a scrapbook that I recently picked up the homecoming of Thorpe Tuanama and Warner. They didn't make it. Now, someday those might, but they're just so recent that they haven't, in my mind, moved up into that top five or six. So getting to what I pared down to, the 1921 ATFA Cleveland Tigers football ticket stuff, being put into a slab by TSA. And probably just say Cleveland Indians, because in 21, the Tigers changed their names to the Indians. It was kind of a...
Like PSA doesn't make mistakes.
I'm finding that out. Been on the forums and stuff, kind of starts is this really something that being true, you know? So, but anyway, in 21, Cleveland Tigers, Cleveland Indians.
You're breaking up a little. You're breaking up a little bit. Can you find a spot where you get cell phone?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
That's better.
All right, keep on going. Yeah, you're just keep talking about your Cleveland Indian ticket.
Okay. And so it probably should say Cleveland Indians, but that's neither here nor there. It was, I think it was first appeared in Leland's auction, and then I purchased it when it showed up in the Heritage auction. And... I think it may be one of the earliest tickets out there. According to Mike Moran, it's the earliest he's seen, and that he hasn't even seen a 1920 ticket. And I figure he's probably seen a whole lot of memorabilia. And when he made that statement, you know, I kind of realized that I had a pretty significant ticket stub in that particular Cleveland Tigers ticket stub.
Interesting. What else? Keep talking about the items you sent us. There was a land grant from the Secretary of the Interior that really caught my eye. When you talk about rare, and Bob and I have tried to define this before, where it's like there's rare, there's unique, and then there's one of a kind. That letter to me was one of a kind.
Sure. I got that. It sold originally in Heritage Auctions with one of his marriage certificates and divorce decree and a movie contract, and shortly after that, it appeared on eBay through Alan Swaim in Van Buren, Arkansas. And it's definitely, I don't know if I could ever kick that one out of my top five. It's something that I think is pretty special. And it's also...
Describe it for our listeners, because Bob and I have had the advantage of seeing it, yeah.
Sure. It's from the Department of the Interior, United States Indian Service, and it says, I enclose herewith B. Simple Patton for, and then it describes the land that's being deeded to him, east of the Indian Meridian, Oklahoma, containing 160 acres. So he's getting his 160-acre allotment. Then for arrow, purse, and emblem of citizenship are being forwarded under separate cover. The secretary requests that you keep the arrow always. It will be to you a symbol of your noble race and of the pride you feel and the pride that you come from the first of all Americans. The purse will always say to you that the money you gain from your labor must be wisely kept. The emblem of citizenship is to be worn in this buttonhole of your coat. Wear this badge always, and may the eagle that is on it never see you do aught of which the flag will not be proud. Wishing you success in your future undertakings. I am very sincerely Horace J. Johnson. This is December
15th, 1916. Was 160 acres given to every Indian, or did Thorpe do something special to get 160 acres?
No, it was part of the Indian allotment, trying to protect the Indians' personal land that and give them some try to create a white society for them. When before they did the land runs in Oklahoma, and
you live in Oklahoma. Have you ever looked up where that 160 acres is that was given to Thorpe, and then seen who owns it now?
You know, I've looked at it on online, and of where it was. But I've never looked to see whether he still owns it. Now, I know he sold his mineral rights because I have that document also.
Wow. Unbelievable.
You had a
you
had a passenger. Oh, go ahead, Captain. You had a passenger list from the Finland, and from previous emails with you and I know that the Finland was the ship that took Jim Thorpe to the 1912 Olympics, because I have a picture of him on that ship, and I'd narrowed down from the time frame that was the only time he was ever on a ship, and then you chimed in with, yes, it was the Finland, which I thought was a really cool way to put a bow on a piece in my collection. Tell us about that and how you got that.
Okay, and actually, you know, he did go on the 1913 tour with the Chicago White Sox and New York Giants, and so he was on ship then, and then in 1945 he was on a merchant marine ship, but that picture is definitely on when he was on the SS Finland. And it just on top, it has a flag with a red star, which is the emblem of the Red Star Line. And it's on front, it says the Red Star Line, SS Finland, passenger list. And then it just lists everybody who was on the ship.
Including a young lieutenant.
Yes, there was George S. Patton, Lieutenant George S. Patton, who was in the Modern Pentathlon. And I also highlighted Eugene Leroy Mercer. A lot of people don't know who he is, but he was a three-time All-American for the University of Pennsylvania at fullback. And only high school boy in history to clear 12 foot with a spruce pole. He was fifth in the long jump at the 1912 Olympics and sixth in the decathlon, and is in the College Hall of Fame. And of course, you have Lewis Swanman, James Thorpe, and Glenn Warner, and Shane Sullivan.
Yep.
And then there's James Manal, who Amos Alonzo Stagg at Chicago coached, and he was fifth in the pentathlon and ended up getting hurt in the pentathlon and didn't get to compete in the decathlon. But what's interesting about him is that in the Central Region Trials back in 1912, they did not have just one Olympic trials. They had several Olympic trials, and he competed in the Central one, and he played first in the decathlon. But the AAU scored by total sum of his placing instead of the newly established scoring tables. It wasn't until 1987 that when they went back and rescored it, it was discovered that he had actually broken the world record in it. And so the world record that Thorpe broke in the Olympics, they thought it belonged to Martin Sheridan, but actually would have belonged to James Austin Manal.
Wow. What's the date on that? That ship sailed right June of 1912, right? Or do you have the exact date?
Yeah. June 14th.
And what I love to put things in perspective is there's another famous Red Star ship that in April of 1912 was coming the other way. The Titanic that sank. So, I mean, just think of the history involved in this, because sometimes I have a hard time wrapping my arms around when things happen in history, linearly. And the Titanic seems so long ago, but Jim Thorpe doesn't sometimes. And whatever, 2 months before Jim Thorpe jumps on a ship to head to, to Stockholm, the Titanic, sinks.
It kind of makes you wonder what they were thinking of when they got on the ship, knowing that big old ship like this just sank, even one bigger than this.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
Then
you also have that.
Go ahead.
You also had that Carlisle presentation folder from 1908. Tell us about that too, Mike.
Okay. Now, understand Carlisle. Actually, a lot of people think they were in college, but they actually just had a curriculum through high school. And if they wanted a college curriculum, they had to go over to Dickinson College. And so the athletic program was actually separate. It's an association. And this program is a 1909 program that is honoring the 1908 season. And so there's pictures in there of Joseph Libby, who was the captain of the football team, Mike Belinti, who was a baseball captain, and Thorpe, at the time, was a track captain. He was not the football player yet. So he was still, I think, a third team All-American, but he wasn't the powerhouse he was later on in life. It shows track photos, team photos, and cross-country photos, and shows the who they played in football and baseball and lacrosse and track and the scoring that was involved. Also has the track meet records for the school listed. All the C Award winners and the award events, school song and yell, and photos of Moses Freeman, who was the superintendent, and also of Warner.
It's an amazing folder. I mean, the history in that is just incredible.
Yeah, I've seen three 1912 programs like this. This is the only one I've seen of the 1908, but I've heard there is another one out there. I'm sure there's some others that people just haven't shown, just like I'm just now showing my collection. But I would think the 1908 one might be a little bit harder to find than the 1912 one.
Right. Tying this up a little, are you actually looking for anything on your want list at this time, Mike, as far as filling in any gaps or anything like that? I mean, it sounds like you got a lot of different things that all relate to one another, and obviously many, you know, pieces that, you know, encompass his track and field career, so on and so forth. But do you have anything on your want list you're looking for?
Oh, you know, if I could get Joe's 1907 Thorpe and Greece postcard and his 1907 football postcard and Jeff's cabinet photo and his Olympic photo of Thorpe, Twanum, and Sockles, I'd probably just quit collecting and go on into the sunset. No, yeah, actually, there are. I've got a list of over 100 items that I'm still looking for.
Wow.
I don't have, you know, I would love to get a ticket of his last football game when came out of retirement and played for Chicago and went one more time, Chicago Cardinals.
Yep.
Put him on his their roster, and they played the Chicago Bears. And then May 2nd, 1917 ticket is maybe probably going to be out of my price range, but who knows? You know, that's when the double no hitter of Fred Tone and Jim Hippo Vaughn.
Right.
He was knocked in the winning run in the 10th inning.
Mike, did I ever tell you I have a ticket from the Stockholm Olympics of the day he won the decathlon?
I've seen your tickets. I think you and I have maybe talked before. I've got the first 2 days. You know, it's a 3 day event.
Okay. Yeah, 3 days.
I've got the first 2 days, and you've got the third day.
The third day. The heptathlon was a one-day event, and I've got a ticket from that as well.
Yes, I love that. And I've got an inauguration ticket and a opening ceremonies and when he did the long jump. So I think you've got the tickets I don't have, and I've got the tickets you don't have of all the significant days.
We're like you and I are like Voltron, Mike. If we formed together, we'd be a super collector. What are some interesting stories, you know, of your collecting? Like, I mean, you know, bumping into a relative, or I mean, just you, living in Oklahoma, you're so close to the flame. I mean, it's got to be a lot easier for you to, you know, check up on a lot of that history.
Sure, and I did get to visit one of his relatives, a granddaughter in Yale, Oklahoma, where the only home he ever bought is a museum there in Yale, Oklahoma. It's about an hour and a half east of me. And I took my collection over there, and they called her over, and she invited me to her home. And I'm looking around, and just like we have grandparents' pictures on the wall, she had grandparents' picture on the wall, and I'm staring at Jim Thorpe all over the wall. You know, original.
It's wild, but probably the one that is frustrating me the most is, but also am grateful to have been able to get to know this guy. Actually, he lives in Portland, Oregon, Joe. Sean Hughes.
I don't know him.
You know him?
No, I don't. What's his last name?
Oh, okay. Well, Sean Hughes.
He's the great-grandson
of Henry Rowe Cloud. And Henry Rowe Cloud had left all of his belongings to him, and that can be verified on the internet. His grandma's dad was Henry Rowe Cloud, who was a friend of Jim Thorpe's. Henry's wife was Elizabeth Bender, who was Charles Albert Bender's sister. Baseball Hall of Fame. She taught at Carlisle in 1915 and 16. And I purchased a pair of X spikes from Sean Hughes, who, through the oral history of his family, they were traded to him from Jim Thorpe through Charles Bender, gave him a baseball glove. And we know athletes do that all the time.
Yep.
Henry Rowe Cloud was the superintendent of Haskell. He was in the office. He was director of the Office of Indian Affairs, ordained Presbyterian minister. And I found documentation where Thorpe actually started practicing as a Presbyterian in the 1930s. And I'm wondering if it was through the influence of Henry Rowe Cloud. And Henry Rowe Cloud was also superintendent of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which you may be familiar with, Joe.
I am. And yes, sir.
So, through the oral history, these track spikes were supposed to belong to Jim Thorpe and were traded. And, you know, we know that all of his football items have been, maybe not all of his football items, but we know many of his football and track items have been found. But his track shoes he bought after the Olympics because, you know, he lost his regular shoes or stolen at the Olympics.
Yep.
And then
yep.
Photos of him after the Olympics in track spikes. So he either borrowed some more or bought some, but they've never surfaced. Now, I've not been able to get these documented, but there's a possibility that through that family, I purchased Jim Thorpe track spikes. No one for sure, and how that's ever going to be able to be authenticated, I don't know, but I'm trying. So that's probably my most interesting collected story.
I like that. I mean, sometimes it's those myths are better. It's like, I heard these are Jim Thorpe spikes. You know, that's good enough for me, man.
That's amazing.
You know?
Truly amazing. And Mike, we're almost out of time.
Okay.
I want to ask you one more question for a comment. You got any beginning advice for any collectors?
Yeah, I would say to decide what you want to collect and what your focus is going to be and stick to a budget best you can.
Yep.
If you see anything that looks really unique or you've never seen before, try your best to get it. And don't take long breaks. You know, you hear so many people, well, I got out of it for 20 or 25 years. If you could limit that to, you know, shorter periods of time, then you're not going to miss out on some amazing things possibly if you'll just limit. Find some way.
Great advice.
Stay in the hobby and stay and keep adding to your collection.
Mike, real quick, what do you think is the earliest picture of Jim Thorpe that exists?
Oh, probably the 1907 football ones. You know, 1904 is when he enrolled into Carlisle, and that's when that big chief tablet came about. But as far as I know, anything from 1907 would have to be the earliest that has surfaced that I've seen.
Interesting.
Now, I'm hoping someday that something from Haskell, when he went there in 1898 as 11-year-old, I'm hoping that someday maybe a photo of him at Haskell will appear.
Interesting.
You just never know.
That would be an amazing find if it comes out to the market. Wow. Unbelievable. Truly unbelievable. Well, Mike, we're almost out of time. I really thank you for being on the show today and sharing with our audience what has to be an incredible historical collection of Jim Thorpe items, and what an education on Thorpe. Truly amazing. You are to be commended for your diligence and your collection and what you have. That's amazing to me, truly amazing.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me on. And y'all, don't bid too high on Thorpe things, please.
I give the same advice to you, Mike.
I hear you.
It's been great having you on the show, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. All right, we're going to be in a limited 2-minute warning and wrap up. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you real quick. What'd you learn on today's show?
Best seat in the house, Captain. Just being able, like you said, being able to see and talk to people who have pretty amazing collections. But to be honest, the highlight of the show for me was the 4 or 5 days preceding the show, where I got to, you know, talk to you about your collection and how you catalog things, and you know, I had a smile on my face pretty much all morning when I was getting ready for this, just talking about it. I think we should to be continued this, and I'll have some follow up questions for you.
All right, that sounds good. That sounds good. I picked up on today's show. It was nice to look back in time. And where did the time go? Snap your fingers, 60 years have gone by, and just it blows my mind sometimes.
Yeah.
Even though I don't feel like I don't think like a 60-year-old, and I don't act like a 60-year-old, that's for sure. And then secondly, putting in context Mike's collection, seeing that email yesterday of the items that he has, his top items, and it just really blew me away, to say the least. And again, I go back to saying one of the nicest parts of doing what I do is viewing people's collections. And I always go back to seeing Don Gree's collection of Cleveland Browns stuff. His grandfather was the original treasurer of the Browns, and going to his house at the Cleveland National at the end of one show, it just blew me away. I mean, it's just amazing to me to see what people have and what collectors have, and it's so great. And it's preservation of football history, and in Mike's case, preservation of, to be one of the greatest athletes who ever walked the earth. And
yep.
What a story is. It's just it amazes me. It truly amazes me to see all this stuff.
It's interesting.
But anyway, we're almost out of time.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say ESPN's come up with a show on Bo Jackson, and I watched about 10 minutes of it the other day. And I'm like, who's the greater athlete, Bo Jackson or Jim Thorpe? I mean, if you think about it in the context of the time they appeared on the planet, I mean.
Yep. And, you know, I'll go back to the 70s real quick. It was very uncommon. It was not uncommon for guys to play 3 sports or 4 sports in high school. Today, because of specialization, they're lucky they play 1 sport, and that's it. And they're not getting a real balanced view of, you know, all the different sports type of thing. So it doesn't make any sense. All right, we're out of time. Joe, thanks for being on. We'll be back. Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.